Chapter 38. Interactive Three-Dimensional Game. Reaching the top of the Grand Gallery, I clambered over a chunky granite step about 3 feet high. I remembered that it lay, like the roof of the Queen's Chamber, exactly along the east-west axis of the Great Pyramid, and therefore marked the point of transition between the northern and southern halves of the monument. Somewhat like an altar in appearance, the step also provided a solid horizontal platform immediately in front of the low square tunnel that served as the entrance to the King's Chamber. Pausing for a moment, I looked back down the gallery, taking in once again its lack of decoration, its lack of religious iconography, and its absolute lack of any of the recognizable symbolism normally associated with the archaic belief system of the ancient Egyptians. All that registered upon the eye, along the entire 153-foot length of this magnificent geometrical cavity, was its disinterested regularity and its stark, machine-like simplicity. Looking up, I could just make out the opening of a dark aperture chiseled into the top of the eastern wall above my head. Nobody knew when or by whom this foreboding hole had been cut, or how deep it had originally penetrated. It led to the first of the five relieving chambers above the King's Chamber, and had been extended in 1837 when Howard Vyse had used it to break through to the remaining four. Looking down again, I could just make out the point at the bottom of the gallery's western wall, where the near-vertical well shaft began its precipitous 160-foot descent through the core of the pyramid to join the descending corridor far below ground level. Why would such a complicated apparatus of pipes and passageways have been required? At first sight, it didn't make sense, but then nothing about the Great Pyramid did make sense unless you were prepared to devote a great deal of attention to it. In unpredictable ways, when you did that, it would from time to time reward you. If you were sufficiently numerate, for example, as we've seen, it would respond to your basic inquiries into its height and base perimeter by printing out the value of pi. And if you were prepared to investigate further, as we shall see, it would download other useful mathematical tidbits, each a little bit more complex and abstruse than its predecessor. There was a programmed feel about this whole process, as though it had been carefully prearranged. Not for the first time, I found myself willing to consider the possibility that the pyramid might have been designed as a gigantic challenge or learning machine, or better still, as an interactive three-dimensional puzzle set down in the desert for humanity to solve. Antechamber. Just over 3 feet 6 inches high, the entry passage to the King's Chamber required all humans of normal stature to stoop. About 4 feet farther on, however, I reached the antechamber, where the roof level rose suddenly to 12 feet above the floor. The east and west walls of the antechamber were composed of red granite, into which were cut four opposing pairs of wide, parallel slots, assumed by Egyptologists to have held thick portcullis slabs. Three of these pairs of slots extended all the way to the floor and were empty. The fourth, the northernmost, had been cut down only as far as the roof level of the entry passage, that is, 3 feet 6 inches above floor level, and still contained a hulking sheet of granite, perhaps 9 inches thick and 6 feet high. There was a horizontal space of only 21 inches between this suspended stone portcullis and the northern end of the entry passage from which I had just emerged. There was also a gap of a little over 2 feet deep between the top of the portcullis and the ceiling. Whatever function it was designed to serve, it was hard to agree with the Egyptologists that this peculiar structure could have been intended to deny access to tomb robbers. Genuinely puzzled, I ducked under it and then stood up again in the southern portion of the antechamber, which was some 10 feet long and maintained the same roof height of 12 feet. Though much worn, the grooves for the three further portcullis slabs were still visible in the eastern and western walls. There was no sign of the slabs themselves, and indeed it was difficult to see how such cumbersome pieces of stone could have been installed in so severely constricted a working space. I remembered that Flinders Petrie, who had systematically surveyed the entire Giza necropolis in the late 19th century, had commented on a similar puzzle in the second pyramid. The granite portcullis in the lower passage shows great skill in moving masses, as it would need 40 or 60 men to lift it, yet it has been moved and raised into place in a narrow passage where only a few men could possibly reach it. Exactly the same observations applied to the portcullis slabs of the Great Pyramid, if they were portcullis slabs, gateways capable of being raised and lowered. The problem was that the physics of raising and lowering them required that they be shorter than the full height of the antechamber, so that they could be drawn into the roof space to allow the entry and exit of legitimate individuals prior to the closure of the tomb. This meant, of course, that when the bottom edges of the slabs were lowered to the floor to block the antechamber at that level, an equal and opposite space would have opened up between the top edges of the slabs and the ceiling, through which any enterprising tomb robber would certainly have been able to climb. The antechamber clearly qualified as another of the pyramid's many thought-provoking paradoxes, in which complexity of structure was combined with apparent pointlessness of function. An exit tunnel, the same height and width as the entrance tunnel and lined with solid red granite, led off from the antechamber's southern wall, also made of granite, but incorporating a 12-inch thick limestone layer at its very top. After about a further 9 feet, the tunnel debouched into the king's chamber, a massive, somber, red room made entirely of granite, which radiated an atmosphere of prodigious energy and power. Stone enigmas. I moved into the center of the king's chamber, the long axis of which was perfectly oriented east to west, while the short axis was equally perfectly oriented north to south. The room was exactly 19 feet 1 inch in height and formed a precise 2x1 rectangle measuring 34 feet 4 inches long by 17 feet 2 inches wide, with a floor consisting of 15 massive granite paving stones and walls composed of 100 gigantic granite blocks, each weighing 70 tons or more and laid in 5 courses, and with a ceiling spanned by 9 further granite blocks, each weighing approximately 50 tons, the effect was of intense and overwhelming compression. At the chamber's western end was the object which, if the Egyptologists were to be believed, the entire Great Pyramid had been built to house. That object, carved out of one piece of dark, chocolate-colored granite, containing peculiarly hard granules of feldspar, quartz, and mica, was the lidless coffer presumed to have been the sarcophagus of Khufu. Its interior measurements were 6 feet 6.6 inches in length, 2 feet 10.42 inches in depth, and 2 feet 2.81 inches in width. Its exterior measurements were 7 feet 5.62 inches in length, 3 feet 5.31 inches in depth, and 3 feet 2.5 inches in width, an inch too wide, incidentally, for it to have been carried up through the lower and now plugged entrance to the ascending corridor. Some routine mathematical games were built into the dimensions of the sarcophagus. For example, it had an internal volume of 1,166.4 liters and an external volume of exactly twice that at 2,332.8 liters. Such a precise coincidence could not have been arrived at accidentally. The walls of the coffer had been cut to machine-age tolerances by craftsmen of enormous skill and experience. It seemed, moreover, as Flinders Petrie admitted with some puzzlement after completing his painstaking survey of the Great Pyramid, that these craftsmen had access to tools such as we ourselves have only now reinvented. Petrie examined the sarcophagus particularly closely and reported that it must have been cut out of its surrounding granite block with straight saws, 8 feet or more in length. Since the granite was extremely hard, he could only assume that these saws must have had bronze blades, the hardest metal then supposedly available, inset with cutting points made of even harder jewels. The character of the work would certainly seem to point to diamond as being the cutting jewel, and only the considerations of its rarity in general and its absence from Egypt interfere with this conclusion. An even bigger mystery surrounded the hollowing out of the sarcophagus, obviously a far more difficult enterprise than separating it from a block of bedrock. Here Petrie concluded that the Egyptians must have adapted their sawing principle into a circular instead of a rectilinear form, curving the blade round into a tube which drilled out a circular groove by its rotation. Thus, by breaking away the cores left in such grooves, they were able to hollow out large holes with a minimum of labor. These tubular drills varied from 1/4 inch to 5 inches diameter, and from 1/30 to 1/5 inch thick. Of course, as Petrie admitted, no actual jeweled drills or saws had ever been found by Egyptologists. The visible evidence of the kinds of drilling and sawing that had been done, however, compelled him to infer that such instruments must have existed. He became especially interested in this and extended his study to include not only the King's Chamber sarcophagus, but many other granite artifacts and granite drill cores which he collected at Giza. The deeper his research, however, the more puzzling the stone-cutting technology of the ancient Egyptians became. The amount of pressure, shown by the rapidity with which the drills and saws pierced through the hard stones, is very surprising, Petrie reported. Probably a load of at least a ton or two was placed on the 4-inch drills cutting in granite. On the granite core number 7, the spiral of the cut sinks 1 inch in the circumference of 6 inches, a rate of ploughing out which is astonishing. These rapid spiral grooves cannot be ascribed to anything but the descent of the drill into the granite under enormous pressure. Wasn't it peculiar that at the supposed dawn of human civilization, more than 4,500 years ago, the ancient Egyptians had acquired what sounded like industrial-age drills, packing a ton or more of punch and capable of slicing through hard stones like hot knives through butter? Petrie could come up with no explanation for this conundrum, nor was he able to explain the kind of instrument used to cut hieroglyphs into a number of diorite bowls with 4th dynasty inscriptions which he found at Giza. The hieroglyphs are incised with a very free cutting point. They are not scraped or ground out, but are ploughed through the diorite with rough edges to the line. This bothered the logical Petrie because he knew that diorite was one of the hardest stones on earth, far harder even than iron. Yet here it was in ancient Egypt, being cut with incredible power and precision by some as yet unidentified graving tool. As the lines are only 1/150 inch wide, Petrie reported, it is evident that the cutting point must have been much harder than quartz, and tough enough not to splinter when so fine an edge was being employed. Probably only 1/200 inch wide. Parallel lines are graved only 1/30 inch apart from center to center. In other words, Petrie was envisaging an instrument with a needle-sharp point of exceptional, unprecedented hardness, capable of penetrating and furrowing diorite with ease, and capable also of withstanding the enormous pressures required throughout the operation. What sort of instrument was that? By what means would the pressure have been applied? How could sufficient accuracy have been maintained to scour parallel lines at intervals of just 1/30 inch? At least it was possible to conjure a mental picture of the circular drills with jeweled teeth which Petrie supposed must have been used to hollow out the King's Chamber sarcophagus. I found, however, that it was not so easy to do the same for the unknown instrument capable of incising hieroglyphs into diorite at 2500 BC, at any rate, not without assuming the existence of a far higher level of technology than Egyptologists were prepared to consider. Nor was it just a few hieroglyphs or a few diorite bowls. During my travels in Egypt, I had examined many stone vessels, dating back in some cases to pre-dynastic times, that had been mysteriously hollowed out of a range of materials such as diorite, basalt, quartz crystal, and metamorphic schist. For example, more than 30,000 such vessels had been found in the chambers beneath the Third Dynasty step pyramid of Zoser at Saqqara. That meant that they were at least as old as Zoser himself, in other words, around 2650 BC. Theoretically, they could have been even older than that, because identical vessels had been found in pre-dynastic strata dated to 4000 BC and earlier, and because the practice of handing down treasured heirlooms from generation to generation had been deeply ingrained in Egypt since time immemorial. Whether they were made in 2500 BC or 4000 BC or even earlier, the stone vessels from the step pyramid were remarkable for their workmanship, which once again seemed to have been accomplished by some as yet unimagined, and indeed almost unimaginable, tool. Why unimaginable? Because many of the vessels were tall vases with long, thin, elegant necks and widely flared interiors, often incorporating fully hollowed-out shoulders. No instrument yet invented was capable of carving vases into shapes like these, because such an instrument would have had to have been narrow enough to have passed through the necks, and strong enough, and of the right shape, to have scoured out the shoulders and the rounded interiors. And how could sufficient upward and outward pressure have been generated and applied within the vases to achieve these effects? The tall vases were by no means the only enigmatic vessels unearthed from the Pyramid of Zoser and from a number of other archaic sites. There were monolithic urns with delicate ornamental handles left attached to their exteriors by the carvers. There were bowls, again with extremely narrow necks like the vases, and with widely flared, pot-bellied interiors. There were also open bowls, and almost microscopic vials, and occasional strange wheel-shaped objects cut out of metamorphic schist, with inwardly curled edges planed down so fine that they were almost translucent. In all cases, what was really perplexing was the precision with which the interiors and the exteriors of these vessels had been made to correspond. Curve matching curve, over absolutely smooth, polished surfaces, with no tool marks visible. There was no technology known to have been available to the ancient Egyptians capable of achieving such results, nor for that matter would any stone carver today be able to match them, even if he were working with the best tungsten carbide tools. The implication, therefore, is that an unknown or secret technology had been put to use in ancient Egypt. Ceremony of the sarcophagus. Standing in the king's chamber, facing west, the direction of death amongst both the ancient Egyptians and the Maya, I rested my hands lightly on the gnarled granite edge of the sarcophagus, which Egyptologists insist had been built to house the body of Khufu. I gazed into its murky depths, where the dim electric lighting of the chamber seemed hardly to penetrate, and saw specks of dust swirling in a golden cloud. It was just a trick of light and shadow, of course, but the king's chamber was full of such illusions. I remembered that Napoleon Bonaparte had paused to spend a night alone here during his conquest of Egypt in the late 18th century. The next morning, he had emerged pale and shaken, having experienced something which had profoundly disturbed him, but about which he never afterwards spoke. Had he tried to sleep in the sarcophagus? Acting on impulse, I climbed into the granite coffer and lay down, face upwards, my feet pointed towards the south and my head to the north. Napoleon was a little guy, so he must have fitted comfortably. There was plenty of room for me, too. But had Khufu been here as well? I relaxed and tried not to worry about the possibility of one of the pyramid guards coming in and finding me in this embarrassing and probably illegal position. Hoping that I would remain undisturbed for a few minutes, I folded my hands across my chest and gave voice to a sustained, low-pitched tone, something I had tried out several times before at other points in the king's chamber. On those occasions, In the center of the floor, I had noticed that the walls and ceilings seemed to collect the sound, to gather and to amplify it and project it back at me, so that I could sense the returning vibrations through my feet and scalp and skin. Now, in the sarcophagus, I was aware of very much the same effect, although seemingly amplified and concentrated many times over. It was like being in the sound box of some giant, resonant musical instrument designed to emit forever just one reverberating note. The sound was intense and quite disturbing. I imagined it rising out of the coffer and bouncing off the red granite walls and ceiling of the king's chamber, shooting up through the northern and southern ventilation shafts and spreading across the Giza plateau like a sonic mushroom cloud. With this ambitious vision in my mind, and with the sound of my low-pitched note echoing in my ears and causing the sarcophagus to vibrate around me, I closed my eyes. When I opened them a few minutes later, it was to behold a distressing sight. 6 Japanese tourists, of mixed ages and sexes, had congregated around the sarcophagus, 2 of them standing to the east, 2 to the west, and 1 each to the north and south. They all looked amazed, and I was amazed to see them. Because of recent attacks by armed Islamic extremists, there were now almost no tourists at Giza, and I had expected to have the king's chamber to myself. What does one do in a situation like this? Gathering as much dignity as I could muster, I stood upright, smiling, and dusted myself off. The Japanese stepped back, and I climbed out of the sarcophagus, cultivating a businesslike manner, as though I did things like this all the time. I strolled to the point 2/3 of the way along the northern wall of the king's chamber, where the entrance to what Egyptologists refer to as the northern ventilation shaft is located, and began to examine it minutely. Some 8 inches wide by 9 inches high, it was, I knew, more than 200 feet in length, and emerged into open air at the pyramid's 103rd course of masonry. Presumably by design rather than by accident, it pointed to the circumpolar regions of the northern heavens at an angle of 32 degrees 30 minutes. This, in the Pyramid Age, around 2500 BC, would have meant that it was directed on the upper culmination of Alpha Draconis, a prominent star in the constellation of Draco. Much to my relief, the Japanese rapidly completed their tour of the king's chamber and left, stooping, without a backward glance. As soon as they had gone, I crossed over to the other side of the room to take a look at the southern shaft. Since I had last been here some months before, its appearance had changed horribly. Its mouth now contained a massive electrical air conditioning unit installed by Rudolf Gantenbrink, who even now was turning his intentions to the neglected shafts of the Queen's Chamber. Since Egyptologists were satisfied that the King's Chamber shafts had been built for ventilation purposes, they saw nothing untoward in using modern technology to improve the efficiency of this task. Yet wouldn't horizontal shafts have been more effective than sloping ones, if their primary purpose had been ventilation and easier to build? It was therefore unlikely to be an accident that the southern shaft of the king's chamber targeted the southern heavens at 45 degrees. During the Pyramid Age, this was the location for the meridian transit of Zeta Orionis, the lowest of the 3 stars of Orion's belt, an alignment I was to discover in due course that would turn out to be of the utmost significance for future pyramid research. The Game Master. Now that I had the chamber to myself again, I walked over to the western wall on the far side of the sarcophagus and turned to face east. The huge room had an endless capacity to generate indications of mathematical game playing. For example, its height, 19 feet 1 inch, was exactly half the length of its floor diagonal, 38 feet 2 inches. Moreover, since the king's chamber formed a perfect 1x2 rectangle, was it conceivable that the pyramid builders were unaware that they had also made it express and exemplify the golden section? Known as phi, the golden section was another irrational number like pi that could not be worked out arithmetically. Its value was the square root of 5 plus 1 divided by 2, equivalent to 1.61803. This proved to be the limiting value of the ratio between successive numbers in the Fibonacci series, the series of numbers beginning 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, in which each term is the sum of the two previous terms. Phi could also be obtained schematically by dividing a line A to B at a point C in such a way that the whole line A to B was longer than the first part A to C in the same proportion as the first part A to C was longer than the remainder C to B. This proportion, which had been proven particularly harmonious and agreeable to the eye, had supposedly been first discovered by the Pythagorean Greeks, who incorporated it into the Parthenon at Athens. There is absolutely no doubt, however, that Phi was illustrated and obtained at least 2,000 years previously in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid at Giza. To understand how, it is necessary to envisage the rectangular floor of the chamber as being divided into two imaginary squares of equal size, with the side length of each square being given a value of 1. If either of these two squares were then split in half, thus forming two new rectangles, and if the diagonal of the rectangle nearest to the center line of the King's Chamber were swung down to the base, the point where its tip touched the base would be phi, or 1.618, in relation to the side length, that is, 1, of the original square. The Egyptologists considered all this was pure chance, yet the pyramid builders had done nothing by chance. Whoever they had been, I found it hard to imagine more systematic and mathematically minded people. I'd had quite enough of their mathematical games for one day. As I left the King's Chamber, however, I could not forget that it was located in line with the 50th course of the Great Pyramid's masonry at a height of almost 150 feet above the ground. This meant, as Flinders Petrie pointed out with some astonishment, that the builders had managed to place it at the level where the vertical section of the pyramid was halved, and where the area of the horizontal section was half that of the base, where the diagonal from corner to corner was equal to the length of the base, and where the width of the face was equal to half the diagonal of the base. Confidently and efficiently fooling around with more than 6 million tons of stone, creating galleries and chambers and shafts and corridors more or less at will, achieving near-perfect symmetry, near-perfect right angles, and near-perfect alignments to the cardinal points, the mysterious builders of the Great Pyramid had found the time to play a great many other tricks as well with the dimensions of the vast monument. Why did their minds work this way? What had they been trying to say or do? And why, so many thousands of years after it was built, did the monument still exert a magnetic influence upon so many people from so many different walks of life who came into contact with it? There was a Sphinx in the neighborhood, so I decided that I would put these riddles to it.